Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 550. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about shrines and temples, parks and palaces, a fish market, and cosplay as we go to Tokyo, Japan. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. One correction with this week's episode on Tokyo, Japan. At the time this was recorded, we were still planning a 2017 trip to Tokyo with the Amateur Traveler Group, and I apologize, but that trip is no longer happening, even though we talk about it in this episode. Let's talk about Tokyo. I'd like to welcome to the show Jason Andrew Jenkins from anepiceducation.com and also Epic Education Radio, which is another travel podcast focusing on family travel. Jason, welcome to the show.
Hi, glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Today we're going to talk about Tokyo, and we've done an episode on Tokyo a long time ago, but it has been long enough that I wanted to come in and do another episode, or actually I wanted Jason to come in and do another episode, because I've only been in Tokyo for about 3 days, so I wasn't going to do it myself. Jason, what is your connection with Tokyo?
I lived in Tokyo from 2001 to 2013, and I returned regularly. My kids were born there. Half of their grandparents live in Osaka, so we returned to Tokyo regularly. I still have work there and friends. But yeah, lived and worked there for 13 years. My kids were in local schools there as well.
And I'm guessing that there was romance involved as well. You ended up in Japan since you have in-laws in Osaka.
Sure. There's a long and short version of this, but basically I met my wife, who is Japanese. I met her in Atlanta, my hometown, in 1997. We moved to Taiwan and we lived in Taiwan for 3 years. Then we moved to Tokyo in 2001, and that's where we got married and had kids. And now those kids are 14 and 10.
Excellent. And why should someone go to Tokyo?
Oh, there is a myriad of reasons, and I'm sure that most people know some of those reasons if they're interested in Japan. But I think Japan is one of those places that sort of fuses the past and the future in a way like no other place, as far as the sort of the modern and the ancient. And I think sometimes that can be a really appealing sort of juxtaposition. Japanese food is the best in the world, and this goes far beyond your usual sushi or teriyaki or the things that yakitori, the things that people think is some of the most diverse, healthy, and delicious food anywhere in the world. And there's also a unique dining culture. Many of your listeners probably know there's a unique bathing culture, the onsens, the hot springs that you can go to. Eating, bathing, sleeping is a unique experience, has a unique history. And then, of course, some of the obvious things of it's incredibly safe, it's clean. Perhaps I should point out it's not as expensive as people think. They think of Japan being one of the most expensive places because it shows up on those Forbes and Business Insider lists as one of the most expensive places in the world. Those numbers are actually pulled from banks when they move one banker from New York and they put him into an apartment in downtown Tokyo. Of course, that's going to be very expensive. Tokyo can be a lot more reasonable than people think, and it's a fantastic place to explore.
You mentioned not that expensive. I was surprised by that. When I was in Tokyo, I was there for a press trip and then stayed on my own. And, you know, when I was there on the press trip, they put me up in the fancy hotel the Beatles stayed in, and I'm sure that would have been quite a lot. But I stayed in February, so I was getting half-price rates, but I was staying in a hotel that was conveniently located to the subway, not too far out, and it was $50 a night. And that really wasn't my expectation.
Right. Yeah. There are quite a few places that are within $50 to $100 a night. And then, of course, Airbnb has become a huge option. The fate of Airbnb in Japan, or at least in Tokyo, is uncertain at the moment. Maybe this could be compared to several places in the world. I haven't actually read the latest headlines, but there were some sort of lobbyists for the hotel industry with the Olympics coming. But until those things go through, Airbnb can be an exceptional option and value for staying in Japan. However, people need to be aware that a lot of these places are Japanese places, shoes off,
right?
Perhaps different kind of bathing situation. The tub might be a little different, the water heater. There may be a few little things you need to know before you book the place or before you step inside the door, but it can actually add to the experience, I believe.
Right. And a little fair warning, a sleeping mat, a typical Japanese sleeping mat, it's going to be a lot harder than the bed that you're expecting at the Holiday Inn. So that works fine for me with my back, but for other people, that's just something to know. And just put this in perspective, amateur travelers doing two trips this year, one to Japan and one to India. India is less than half the price. I mean, it is still more expensive than a developing country, but it's not as expensive as I thought it would be.
And I think those costs are going down as well.
Interesting.
The yen is dropping, for better or for worse. And this actually may be one of the best times, or at least one of the least expensive times, to visit Japan in general and Tokyo in specific.
Excellent. And then what would you recommend that we do and see in Tokyo?
As I've told many people before, you could spend months in Tokyo alone and still not be able to see and do everything you want. I know a lot of people, and I'm sure many of your listeners, if they're going to make that long flight to Japan, they want to see as much as possible. I can assure you that Tokyo alone can keep you busy for weeks. Now,
what if I only had a couple days? This is actually not just theoretical. Some of us are flying in, for instance, here in June, and we're only going to have a couple days. What's your top things to do?
Let me give you a couple of top things. Now, one of the first things that I recommend for people is I recommend taking the train to Harajuku Station. Many people know the name Harajuku, and they think of Harajuku girls or that sort of modern youth culture. Harajuku is the epicenter of Asian youth culture, and it sort of ripples out around the world. But there's much more to this area. And one of the reasons that I usually recommend starting in Harajuku is because there are several worlds within walking distance of each other. For example, I said the Harajuku area, which there's a street called Takeshita Dori, which is where all the quirky shops and sort of that, when people think of bizarre teen Japanese fashion, that's the kind of place is great for people watching.
And you say bizarre teen fashion, I'm thinking something out of anime, almost cartoon characters walking around.
I guess, yeah. I mean, it depends on the day, and it depends on
the fashion.
It depends on the fashion, and it's become sort of a cliche of itself. Maybe the cool kids don't hang out there anymore, necessarily, but it's a great place to people watch and see bizarre boutiques and shops. Now, just a little north of that, on the other side of the station, is Meiji Jingu, which is a major Shinto shrine, and it's in a little plot. It looks almost like old growth forest. It just seems completely separate from the modern urban Tokyo world. It has the large torii gates. Torii gates are those large wooden archways that you see in major temples and shrines in Japan.
Usually an orange-red.
It depends. The orange-red ones are, I don't get this mixed up, but basically the orange and red ones tend to be temples, which are Buddhist.
Oh, where interesting.
Jinja are shrines, which are Shinto, which is the native Japanese religion. So this is a Shinto shrine, which is sort of an animist religion, and I'm no expert on Shintoism, so I'll stop while I'm ahead. But this is a beautiful, peaceful park that most people put on their itineraries, and for good reason. There's also a lot of weddings here, so it's very common to be walking through the shrine grounds and see a wedding in progress. A lot of people don't know that if you go out, I'm trying to think of this on a map, I think to the west, if you go out the west exit of the shrine, there's a huge open ground, sort of an open air field that some people call the secret park, because a lot of people don't go to this part of the Meiji Jingu grounds. And even in the distance, you might hear kendo practice. There's several traditional arts that are practiced in this sort of rolling hills on that side.
And you mentioned kendo. Not everyone's going to know what that is.
I apologize. Kendo is the Japanese martial art of swordplay. You may have seen people wearing the wire masks. They usually are doing it with wooden swords, of course, but there are practice grounds for kendo and archery in this sort of rolling hills area. So now you've seen sort of a traditional Japan area. You've seen the sort of modern hyper punk fashion area, the trendy area of Harajuku.
Well, hang on. Before you move away from the Meiji shrine, we should just mention who Meiji was, because this is dedicated to the Emperor Meiji, who is the one who modernized Japan. And so that is a very significant person in Japanese history. This is the emperor who basically opened up Japan to Western influence and basically took Japan from a feudal society into a modern industrial nation.
That's right. Emperor Meiji, I think it was late 19th century, the Meiji Restoration. Mm-hmm. When you think about Japan going from the sort of feudal system it was, from swords and samurais to steam locomotives, this is the era where these things were begun.
Okay.
Also, another benefit, in addition to possibly seeing a traditional Japanese wedding taking place, this is also where sumo wrestlers come at certain times for rites of passage. This is also a very popular place at New Year's Eve.
You mentioned the wedding, just a few seconds here.
Sure.
Traditionally, it might be a little harder to tell the wedding's going on because you wouldn't see a woman in white. I know that that has changed somewhat over the years, but white typically a color more of death and funerals, and so a traditional wedding attire was brightly colored. I don't know how much that has changed or changed while you were there at all.
I think it's changed. I've never seen a Japanese bride, or at least a traditional Japanese bride, in anything but white.
Interesting.
The sort of kimono that she's wearing is not necessarily wedding dress-like, and mm-hmm. she has sort of a round hat covering her, and then the groom is wearing a formal black and gray kimono, but the procession is what a lot of people like to see, because you have the Shinto priest in the front, then you have sort of his acolytes, for lack of a better word, and then the bride and groom with a large red umbrella trailing behind them, and then the guests of the wedding walking behind them. This is not the only Shinto shrine where you can have these weddings. Actually, one of my good friends got married in Nikko, the temples in Nikko, which was a pretty amazing experience. But yes, she is wearing white.
Interesting, because that is a change, and I thought that that was the case, that that had changed, and it was mainly since the Meiji Restoration, basically since that exposure to the West, and especially, of course, since the movies.
Oh, right, of course. Well, as you may have heard before, a lot of Japanese people take an a la carte approach to religion, and so,
right, sure.
So they may have a Shinto wedding, they may have a Buddhist funeral, and they may have, or mm-hmm. they may have a Christian wedding and a Shinto funeral and a Buddhist coming of age ceremony, so there are quite a few a la carte approaches to religion there.
Well, and when you do see the anybody who is a woman who is dressed in the traditional kimono, have some respect for how graceful she looks, because that kimono can weigh up to like 20 kilograms or over 30 pounds. It may look very cool, but it might actually be pretty heavy.
And it also can be quite tight. My mother-in-law at our wedding actually had circulation problems because the fitters in the United States where we got married, they wrapped it too tightly.
Oh, my.
She was fine, but it was a literal, like, legs going to sleep kind of situation. So it is sort of bound in a certain way. But that's about the extent of the knowledge of Japanese weddings that I have. But Meiji Jingu is definitely a very interesting place to see for a number of reasons. And the fact that you might stumble across one of these weddings in progress is one of them.
Excellent. Where to next?
Well, in the same area, right next to that neighborhood is a place called Omotesando, which is the high street, the Rodeo Drive, if you will. And along here, there are a lot of fancy high-end shops, sort of a promenade. It's a great place for people watching, sit to have a drink or a coffee. A lot of large high-end brand names have their flagship stores here. One place that I often mention, I'm a big fan of contemporary art, and I like to go to museums and galleries. Tokyo is a fantastic place for art in all its forms, but contemporary art in particular. There is a vibrant contemporary art scene. As one example, Louis Vuitton, the famous handbags maker, they have their vanity gallery, if you will, in their flagship store on the Omotesando area. And I tell people to stop here because it's free. It has an amazing view. It's like a maybe 30-foot-high ceilings with large windows that give you a view of the whole area. And then kind of bright and flashy, spunky contemporary art to look at. And this whole promenade is full of small little nooks and crannies, tea shops, fashion. And then at the far end of Omotesando, you reach to the Aoyama area, and there's lots of good eating up in restaurants in that area.
Any particular restaurants you would recommend as long as we're stopping in an eating area here or cuisine?
Actually, in that area, I'll be honest with you. One of the main places I eat there is called Commune 246. It's a street stall kind of area.
Okay.
There's a lot that is open year-round that has street stalls that sell Japanese food, Indian food, Hawaiian food of all things. The Japanese food in this area, I quite like it. They sell Japanese craft beer, vegetarian food as well. But the atmosphere is quite nice because it's open air. It's a lot of different stalls within tables sitting in the center with a small stage where there are some performances. So it's a good way to eat some reasonably priced grub and do some people watching.
Well, in terms of Japanese street food, squid balls are one of the things that I'm very aware of. But are there something else that you would recommend?
Street food. Well, squid balls, I guess. Octopus, I think is what
octopus,
you're talking about.
Octopus, sorry, yes.
Takoyaki, right?
Takoyaki.
Takoyaki would be definitely a great food. I think eating that in Kansai, in the Osaka area, is probably the best place for that, but you can find it everywhere. The cousin to takoyaki is something called okonomiyaki. And okonomiyaki has the same sort of batter that the takoyaki are made from, but it's one of those sort of cook-it-yourself type foods. And you said street food, but this is sort of the working class, I won't even say working class, but this is sort of a very common food that a lot of people in the West may have not heard of. And these shops can be found all over Japan. One of my favorite okonomiyaki shops is in the Harajuku Omotesando area. It's called Sakura Tei, which is in another series of galleries called the Design Festa Galleries. Now, what makes okonomiyaki fun to eat in sort of a unique experience is it's like a teppanyaki. If you're familiar with teppanyaki, it's a cook-it-yourself. The grill is built into the table, and the ingredients are brought to you raw. The flour material, usually a raw egg and scallions, some tiny little shrimp and other ingredients, and then whatever else you're going to put into that. It may be pork, it could be seafood, it could be fermented beans or cheese. There's usually restaurants like Okonomiyaki Place I'm mentioning have a wide variety of ingredients. You mix it yourself, you pour it onto the table, you flip it, you chop it, and eat it communally. And it's a really fun way to eat with friends.
And for those of us who are Japanese impaired, who are making very slow progress through learning the card Japanese, is this someplace we can point and say, I want some of that, I want some of that, or is this someplace I'm going to be using my translation app?
That's a good question. In a lot of okonomiyaki places, because it's sort of a casual atmosphere, mm-hmm. It's one of those places where the menus could be in English. I won't guarantee everyone. The place I mentioned, Sakurate, they do have English menus. They have enough non-Japanese guests that they do have English menus. A lot of times the menus will be laminated and have pictures on them.
Sure.
So that, yes, that is a good place.
Or the little plastic food, which is always helpful.
Maybe I should mention that too. If you want authentic Japanese home cooking, but you're concerned about seeing a menu, and that does happen quite a bit in Japan, is there's just kanji on a board. One place I would recommend that is all over the city, maybe all over the country, is a place called Otoya. We can put this in the show notes if you want, but Otoya is organic Japanese produce, and it's lots of Japanese home cooking, and their menus do have images on them, and it's very easy to kind of pick and choose what you want to eat.
Excellent. You were taking us on a sightseeing tour, and I distracted you with food. Where are we going next?
Oh, I love talking about Japanese food. I miss it quite a bit right now.
Well, you said that was one of the reasons we were coming to Tokyo, so I figured it wasn't a complete distraction.
Oh, well, I mean, I'm talking to you here from Spain, and Spain is no slouch when it comes to food, but my family is really, really missing Japanese food. We've been here a while, and we've been waiting. One other small thing I'd like to add to that, too, is my favorite public park in Tokyo is in this same area right by Meiji Jingu Shrine. It's called Yoyogi Koen, or Koen just means park, so Yoyogi Park. If you get a chance to go there on the weekends, it's a great way to see a slice of life of the people of Tokyo. Everybody from artists and musicians, there'll be a dance class practicing in the park, there'll be little old ladies walking through, there'll be kids. This is where buskers and street performers practice. There's a stage nearby in the same park area where during the warmer months there are festivals there almost every weekend. So there'll be the Thai festival this weekend and the Brazil festival the following weekend. There are a lot of local festivals as well, like the Hokkaido festival, and Hokkaido being the northernmost island of Japan. And that means that there'll be street stalls selling food from Hokkaido. So these kinds of festivals can be a great way to get a little free entertainment and some good grub. That's day one, or one of your days. I know a lot of people want to come to Japan to see the old side, and I would recommend some of those things as well. A lot of people want to go to Sensoji, which is the red temple that you see in a lot of Japanese travel literature. That's in an area called Asakusa. Asakusa is and Sensoji is a great place to see. While you're in that area, this is maybe something that only certain people would like, but not far from there is an area called Yanaka. It's near the Nippori train station, and Yanaka is an old Japanese neighborhood. It's one of the few places in Tokyo that was not bombed or had very little bomb damage during World War II. And so a lot of the old structures, the old houses are still there. Yanaka is actually a graveyard, and it's actually a pretty interesting graveyard if you like to see that kind of side of things. But the neighborhood around it is a great place to walk just if you want to kind of see a little of old Japan. As far as other sort of traditional or old Japan that I would recommend is, most of this is all on the sort of the east side of Tokyo. I would recommend also visiting a place called Ryogoku. Ryogoku is where the sumo stadium is. And if sumo is happening, keep in mind that sumo tournaments are 2 weeks long. So that means you have 14 days to see it. It's not a one night thing. But the tournaments, there are only, I can't remember right now, three, I think, in Tokyo. Then there are a few in other parts of the country. One of those is happening probably about right now. There's usually one in January. And then there are two others in Tokyo. The stadium is really easy to access. It's right next to the train station. If you go early in the morning, you can get what are called free seating, which is the very top row. And they're pretty reasonable. I think they're like about $30 for tickets. I've seen sumo half a dozen times, sometimes with my kids, sometimes with friends. And almost all of those times have been in the upper seats. The only problem is this general admission, meaning that if you get up and you come back, that seat might not be there.
But you're going to get a lot less sumo sweat on you, too. So there's that.
Well, that's the thing is when I'm talking about the top row, these aren't nosebleed seats. This is not a large stadium. You can literally hear the two wrestlers, their bodies slap together. You can hear that from the very top stands. Now, right next to the sumo stadium is the Edo Tokyo Museum.
Oh, yeah. I've been there.
And if you want the comprehensive view of the city of Tokyo, this is the place to do it. It's a great museum for you on your own. It's a great museum for families, for kids. It's got plenty of sort of hands-on and interactive things and sort of shows how it came from Edo, which was the old name of Tokyo, to the city it is today. Another museum that I like, another sort of historical museum, if you take the Oedo line, which is one of the main circular train lines through Tokyo, a few stations south in a place called Kiyosumi Shirakawa, there is another museum called the Fukagawa Edo Museum. This is much smaller, but it is a recreation of an Edo-era village. So you kind of step down into it. You can walk into the houses. You can see the way people lived in a way that is unique and quite fun. And then right across the street is a nice traditional garden.
And when we say the Edo period, we were comparing notes before we started recording here, and Edo turned into Tokyo, we figured in the 1300s, if I've got my memory serving me correctly, when the Shogun basically moved up here from Kyoto to get a little more independence from the emperor, as the Shoguns were ruling Japan in fact, if not in name, at that time.
Yeah, I think the Edo period ended
in the 1800s, wasn't it? With the Meiji Restoration.
Exactly. That's when this period began. My home, where I lived for most of my 13 years in Tokyo, was along the Sumida-gawa, the Sumida River, and that's the river where Edo formed. That's in the same neighborhood. I lived on sort of the east side of town, which is a lot of the older traditional places are. I could even give a shout out to my old neighborhood, a place called Monzen Nakacho, which actually has the home of sumo.
Oh, interesting.
What is the name of that temple? There is a temple where sumo is supposed to have originated. The sumo wrestlers, when they reach the Yokozuna status, which Yokozuna means like grand champion, their names are carved into a statue on the backside of this temple. Ah, it's called Tomioka Hachimangu. That's the name of the temple.
There we go. Well, the one thing I would say, too, just from a practical point of view for non-Japanese speakers, if you're going out to the Edo Museum, for instance, it's very easy to get there on the subway from the center part of Tokyo. But I would caution you that when you go into, for instance, the train station downtown in Tokyo, it's very easy to look at the map and get English and Japanese. But as you get out a little further, for instance, the station I know by Edo, and you're looking at that map, was only in Japanese characters when I was there, which is a couple of years ago. And so as you get a little further away from downtown, it's useful to have your translation app or to have it clearly in mind what your destination is. And I would say that Japan is a great place to have a data plan so that you can use your navigation apps and things like that. And we've talked about on other shows, for instance, that addresses in Japanese don't make a lot of sense to those of us who grew up with a different system.
Yeah, street addresses, there's a completely inverted system, and I won't even get into that.
Yeah, we have talked about that in a recent episode of the show that we did on Osaka. So listen to that episode if you want to hear the interesting system that they use there.
Chris, if I may, just since you were talking about a few sort of tips on navigation, I have a couple of things I'd like to throw in there that I think would be useful for people. First of all, public transportation is fantastic in Japan. There's a lot of different trains. However, some of the trains are run by different companies. And so when you get a train map from one particular station, the station you're looking for might be in very small print because it's not theirs. They emphasize their own stations. It's much easier to get train maps now that have all of the stations in English. But however, that's something to point out. Another thing I would mention is that as far as when you step out of a station, there are lots of public maps that show you where you are situated. Uh-huh. However, they are not set up in the north, south, east, west sort of quadrant that we're accustomed to. When you're facing a map, that is the direction the map is facing. You have to look into a corner of the map to see where north is. So if the map is not facing north, it will be facing exactly the direction it is. And that threw me off for years because I would always go up and start heading in the wrong direction. If you're facing south and you're looking at a map, that map is having south sort of aligned at the top. And that's an important thing to remember.
And not a bad system either, as long as you know that that's the system.
Exactly. Because you end up turning the map that way in your hand sometimes, right?
Right, exactly.
Another thing that I mentioned that is probably common for many places in the world where language is going to be an issue is wherever you choose to stay, get a business card from the lobby. Yep. Business cards are in every business in Japan, almost every business. If you're staying in an Airbnb, get a business card from a hair salon down the street. But have that card with a Japanese address so that if you do need to get back somewhere, you have a copy of the address because there's a good chance that your taxi driver or the people on the street will not be able to speak to you in English. And it's good to have an address in hand in Japanese.
Yep, always a good idea. Well, and the other thing I would say, I mentioned that I was there in February, and we should talk a little bit about weather.
Okay.
I don't know when you would suggest to go to Tokyo.
My favorite times to be in Tokyo are spring and fall. Mm-hmm. I am not a cold weather person, so I don't like to be there in winter. However, if you have friends who are from Canada or Minnesota or Vladivostok, they think that Tokyo's winters are very, very mild.
Well, and when we say mild, when I was there, they had an inch of snow and the city shut down. It's just not used to snow. It can get it, but it's very rare.
In the 13 years I was there, it probably snowed 7-8 times. I mean, where it stuck, and there was a couple times where everything did shut down. So winters are mild. However, Japanese housing, and this may not affect you if you're staying in a nice hotel.
Good point.
Japanese housing is not insulated well. You heat the room, you don't heat the house.
Right.
And so you could be nice and snug in the living room, and then you step into the hallway, and it's the same temperature as it is outside. So that's something to consider. Now, back to your weather question. You can go any time of year. However, I should note that Japanese summers, anywhere on Honshu, which is the main island, including Tokyo, or Kansai, which is where Osaka and Kyoto, is very hot, is very humid. I'm trying to think, I mean, at 35 Celsius, been away from Fahrenheit too long. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking
so we're in the 90s.
95, 100 degrees with very strong humidity. I'm from Atlanta. I grew up in Atlanta, and Tokyo is miserable in the summer. And just like the heat in the winter, it's the same with air conditioning. There's lots of air conditioning, but it's only by the room. So when you step out, it is hot, and that means train platforms are very hot as well. So the summertime may be the best time to go for your time schedule, but just be prepared for very hot and humid weather. Now, spring and fall, the fall is fantastic because the maple leaves, if you like to see the leaves change color, you can see that in the city or in, you know, half a dozen directions a day trip. You can see amazing leaves fall in Gunma Prefecture, Tochigi, Chiba to the east, Hakone to the west, and it's an amazing time. But then my favorite, my absolute favorite, is spring. It depends on where you are in the country, but the hanami season that I'm sure some of you listeners have heard of, so hanami means looking at the flowers. This is when all of the cherry blossoms pop open, and it does something to Japanese people. I joke, I call it like a spiritual spring break where people kind of let loose. Everybody sets up tarps under the blossoms and have, I won't say wild and raucous, but very convivial parties, drinking sake and singing. And I worked at a Japanese company for 13 years while I was there, and you would have these company picnics, and the most sort of uptight guy in the corner loosens his tie and starts belting out show tunes. It really does something to people. It's a nice sign of spring to see when all of the petals start to, the wind blows and they kind of blow through the air like a snowstorm. It's a great time. The mood is extremely high and the weather is very, very pleasant.
Although I do know if you're planning on being there in April, for instance, for the cherry blossoms, better plan in advance. We actually tried to do the amateur traveler trip in April and they said, oh, no, no, you have to plan that a year in advance. More expensive and more advanced planning needed.
You bring up a good point, and not only in the planning, but also in the unpredictability. The blossoms do not open on a set date.
Sure, yeah.
there's so many different factors. And then, of course, if the weather is quirky, I remember one year, right as they open, and they're only open for 2 weeks, right? So the prime weekend for them to open, it poured down rain, which was unusual for that time, but it knocked most of the blossoms off. It was a bust that year. So it's hard to predict. The usual time for Tokyo is late March, early April, you know, give or take a day. It starts earlier in the south and later in the north as basically as the country heats up. And the reverse would be true for fall leaves. So the fall leaves start to turn red starting in the north and then heading towards the south. But both times are a great time to be in Japan.
Excellent. Well, we should go back to our itinerary. We are going to run out of time before we run out of things to see in Tokyo, which we knew would happen.
Okay. Basically, just giving you 2 days. Let me just throw a couple other things that I think definite must-dos.
You had a couple things that were not must-dos. Let's cover those briefly.
Okay. I think you had asked me, like,
what do the guidebooks recommend that you would skip?
You see the Tokyo Tower a lot.
Which is a replica of the Eiffel Tower, except in orange.
That's right. It looks like the Eiffel Tower, but it's orange and white, a little bit of it's white. But especially if you're there for a week, I would not spend your time going there. I would even venture to say the same for the Tokyo Sky Tree, which I don't know if it's still a Guinness World Record. It's one of those really super tall platforms. It's on the east side of town. It's a huge draw. However, it's very expensive. It is very tall, but it's not even in town. So if you like to be in a tall place, you can see far. It can be impressive. I had a friend that was there that actually saw a storm coming over the city during the summer from above, which is impressive in its own way. But it's just a high place. I don't think that that is that impressive. If you want a view of the city, I would highly suggest going to the Mori Building, which is in the area called Roppongi. On the 35th floor of the Mori Building is the Mori Museum, which is an amazing contemporary art museum. But then around the outside of the Mori Museum, it's called the Sky Deck or Sky Lounge or something like that. And it is a completely 360-degree glassed-in view. And Roppongi is near the center of the city.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it has roads sort of like a wagon wheel going around it. Time your visit. The museum is often exceptional, the collection that they have or the shows that are moving through there. But if you can time your viewing to be in that place at sunset is a high recommend for me. The Morty Museum is open quite late. I think they're open till 9 every day but Tuesday. So it's highly possible to time your visit to be watching the sunset from there and seeing all the streetlights of the city either before you go to the museum or after. Other places that I would say not to avoid but that some people recommend that I don't is the Imperial Palace. A lot of people, they want to go to the Imperial Palace. Unfortunately, most of it you can't see anyway. It's blocked off. There are some nice gardens, but for me, if you're there for a week or even for 2 weeks, there's other things that I would recommend you see instead. The only day I recommend going to the Imperial Palace is on the Emperor's birthday, which I think it's in January. And that's one day where you can literally go into a courtyard and the Imperial family stands behind bulletproof glass and waves and lots of Japanese people. There's a sort of a national fervor and people wave their flags. And that's kind of an interesting cultural event. But that's the only time that you're actually allowed into that part of the palace.
And that's the 23rd of December.
Thank you. Thank you. 23rd of December. So I usually skip the Imperial Palace on short trips if I'm showing people around. The third, mixed emotions here, should you go to the Tsukiji Fish Market? Yes, absolutely. If you like fish, if you want to see a fish market, if you want to eat the best sushi and sashimi in your life, absolutely. But the tuna auctions, everybody wants to see the tuna auctions, and I don't get it. I've done it 2 or 3 times. I was there for the fish. It's a bunch of men standing around sticking their fingers in frozen fish carcasses.
Very early in the morning.
Very early in the morning. When I was doing it, and I don't know if this should be on the air, but the fish market, the best time to be there is very early, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And the trains are not running. The trains do not run overnight.
Oh, okay.
They do not run 24 hours. Maybe that's an important thing. Most train lines finish by midnight, 1 o'clock at the very latest, and they don't start running again until sometimes 5:30 in the morning. So the only ways to get there is to either get up very early in the morning and take the first train or stay up all night, perhaps imbibing, as I have done before, and then show up by taxi. Sometimes this has been bad news, because drunk tourists or drunk people show up and are disrespectful to the fishmongers, and that will shut down the fish market to tourists for a week. There have been cases where some British guy knocked over some boxes or tried to kiss a fish for a selfie, and they will shut down the auction or shut down the market for tourists for a week in punishment. So it's something to keep in mind. However, the actual seeing the tuna auction, now there's more steps to it. You have to register at something like 3 or 4, and then you have to sit in the refrigerated room for an hour and wait, and I see no value in it. However, eating sushi, having a sushi breakfast at one of the stalls in the Tsukiji area, if you like that sort of thing, and I certainly do, is worth all of the effort in the getting up early, because it is fantastic. Some certain stalls, and I can't remember their name now, some certain sushiyas, little sushi stands, will have a line that goes around the block, and then there'll be another one that's right next to it that maybe has a line that's got 20 people. Get in a line with the 20 people, because the other one is not that much better. This is sushi at Tsukiji. They're all good.
Excellent. Anything else we should see? We're going to have to do a couple more highlights and then get to some of our wrap-up questions.
Ah, okay. I mentioned the Morty Museum. If you like architecture and you like contemporary art, it's sometimes referred to as the Roppongi Art Triangle. This area was sort of the expat bar area, and it still is. It can be kind of a seedy or awesome, depending on what kind of partier you are. At night, it looks like that, but the area has cleaned up its reputation a lot by putting in a lot of cultural institutions that are very good and very family-friendly as well. The Morty Museum being one, the National Arts Center. It reminds me of Corbusier, the French architect, but I don't know who did it, but an amazing sort of curved building with a variety of art spaces. And then in the Tokyo Midtown area, there's another place called the 2121 Design Site. It has amazing exhibits, hands-on sort of things. I would definitely see these, and there's lots of good people watching there as well. I think a lot of people also like to go to Ginza. Ginza is sort of the old school Rodeo Drive. It's where the old money is, the shopping there. I highly recommend, one of the things I do with everybody is we go into the department stores there and we go to the B1, the B2 floors, B1 being
the
B
basement.
Being basement. Yeah. And these are where the supermarkets and the specialty food shops are.
Oh, okay.
And to see the food in these areas, I highly recommend this to you, Chris. If you're going to be there, go to Ginza. There's other major department stores in other parts of town, but Ginza may be one of the better places for this. Go to B1 and B2. and just look through the food. The dessert sections look almost like a jewelry shop. The stuff is behind glass. It's in little display cases. Everything is perfectly packaged. And, you know, I should mention that they're often free samples. So it's a good way to see an amazing amount of food. From Shinbashi, which is a short walk away from Ginza, you can jump on the Yudakamome monorail. It's a monorail that above ground train that goes out to some man-made islands called Odaiba. Odaiba has been criticized as being just a space-age shopping mall. It's sort of a tourist area, but it's a fun ride over the bay. I highly recommend getting on the first car because there's no conductor on this. It's automatic. So if you wait, even if you have to miss one train, wait at the front car so that you can get on because it's just a big glass window. And it rolls through town, and then it rolls over the water, and then it rolls out to these man-made islands with some bizarre buildings. If you've seen any modern Godzilla movie in the last 10 to 20 years, you've probably seen him destroying these islands. But Fuji Television has one of their main stations there, and it's a kind of an interesting, odd building. Amazing Science Museum there, Maritime Science Museum, a number of interesting things, man-made beach, some great restaurants that overlook the bay. Probably the best view of Tokyo Bay back into Tokyo at sunset is from this beach on Odaiba.
Now, are we heading out towards Yokohama at that point?
Actually, no.
Okay.
I'm trying to orient myself. Yokohama would be sort of southwest,
yeah,
where Odaiba is literally into the bay, which is, I guess, definitely south or southeast,
okay.
I guess
okay.
you could say. These are islands that are built into the bay. There's a lot of convention centers. If you were to come to Japan for a large, like an electronics convention or medical equipment or whatever, there's these huge convention halls out there. Well, this is also a place where lots of cosplayers, the people who dress in their costumes of manga characters, they almost on a regular basis have their sort of little get-togethers out there. So you'll be walking amongst these odd buildings and see people dressed as manga characters, setting up cameras to take pictures of themselves. My daughter and I used to ride our bikes from our house out to these islands and kind of pedal around that area because she liked to look at them.
So we're going to do this a little backwards this time. Usually we start with what would you recommend for an itinerary? Now that we've talked about all this, if I had a week, how would you allocate it?
Okay. I would probably, sort of in the order I said them, I would definitely do the Harajuku Omotesando Meijijingu as probably day one.
Okay.
And then east side, the sort of traditional stuff, the Sensoji Temple, Yanaka, the Sumo Stadium, the Edo Museum, all of that on day two.
Okay.
If you are interested in Ginza Rodeo Drive area, if you're interested in the Odaiba area that I mentioned, that would be a good day three. Any of these mornings, because the fish market is so early, that could be done in the early morning.
Might be good to do that a day that you're not on the right time zone.
I'm glad you brought that up. When friends would visit me, I frequently brought them the morning after they arrived because they were awake already. They were awake anyway. That worked well. So there's our first few days. If you are interested in the art triangle that I mentioned would be an interesting place to see. If you have the time, I think a ride to the west side of town, to an area called Inokashira Park, and the station is called Kichijoji. Inokashira Park is one of my favorite parks in the city, and it's vibrant on the weekends. And then a short walk from there is the Ghibli Museum. And the Ghibli, if you're familiar with Hayao Miyazaki, he is a famous Japanese animator. He made the movie Spirited Away. He made My Neighbor Totoro. He has a museum there that he designed himself that is not just for kids. It's definitely a highlight of visiting Japan is to go in this place. The exhibits are not in any particular order. He doesn't want you to take pictures. He doesn't want you to look at a map. He wants you to wander. And it looks, I guess, something like Hogwarts is the only thing that comes to mind, even though it's not on a grand scale like that. But as far as just different paths or leading to different ways, as well as telling the story of his creative journey and the history of animation, how animation became what it is today, single cell to computer generated. I think that's a great place to spend an afternoon. There's an area called Nakano that's not far from there, which has a great sort of little alley restaurant network system that is a good place to wander and just step in for a bowl of ramen or some street food, like you mentioned, yakitori.
Now, the bowl of ramen, that is a place you're going to need your translation app or some Japanese, in my experience, because you're talking about these ramen places where you go and you get your ticket from the machine outside, which often will only have the Japanese characters for the different soups, and then you bring it inside and get your soup. So if you can't read kanji or don't have your translation app, you're going to be doing soup potluck here. So.
Yes, and usually, I guess we used to say the plainest ones are usually at the top. So if you're concerned,
good to know.
They usually go into the extra toppings towards the bottom. That is a general rule. But yes, there's a vending machine that you order from there. Now, I've basically told you all stuff in Tokyo downtown. If you wanted to do some day trips outside the city, you mentioned Yokohama. Yokohama's, you know, an hour or less by train. It's another super urban, modern city with a great sort of bayside area that's great to walk. Hakone, which is a little further away, is sort of the Tokyo's mountain retreat. There's lots of ryokan, which are the traditional Japanese inns with hot springs in them. That's a great place for hot springs. There's a beautiful lake that you can take a boat out onto. Kamakura
was one of my favorites.
I've mentioned it before to people saying, if you can't make it to Kyoto, but you want to see sort of the old school Japan shrines, that's the place to go. Now, my wife, being Japanese, she rolls her eyes and says, oh, they're nothing alike. maybe not. But Kamakura is a great place to walk and see old temples and shrines. There's some actually great hiking trails not far from there. I actually wrote about this for Japan Times recently. I could send you the maps or anything for the show notes if you want to look for the hiking trails. And this is somewhere that you can go and come back in the day. You can eat. It's an easy day trip.
Well, and three things that I would recommend in Kamakura. One is you've got to see the large Buddha, which is sitting outside because the big building that used to house it has been washed away twice in typhoons, but the Buddha is still there. This is a bronze Buddha, I want to say. And so it's green. And so you've probably seen pictures of it. And then one of the Buddhist temples that's in a bamboo grove, I thought was just particularly lovely. And then there's an interesting and there's an interesting Shinto shrine where people do money laundering.
literal laundering, right?
You wash your money for good luck. The idea is that if you wash your money, you get more money. It's a fascinating thing to watch.
Yes, and that's actually along one of the hiking trails. So
I hiked out there from the city. It's a bit of a hike.
It is, but it's a rewarding walk. You do feel like you've left the city. Now, if you really want to leave the city, there are a number of places that I could tell you to go. But my personal favorite is I like Gunma Prefecture, and I like a place called Minakami because there's a lot of great outdoor activities there. In the winter, they have ski and snowboard and backcountry, but that's not my thing. My thing is canyoning. I like whitewater rafting and canyoning. Minakami is in a bowl in the Japanese Alps, which means that the winters are quite long there, but then the snow melt as it comes down gives it some really just beautiful whitewater rapids that you can go on a canyoning or rafting trips. There's a number of places up there. And my favorite onsen is very close to these rafting companies. So one of them is called Canyons, just canyons.jp. It's run by a Kiwi guy, so there's English speakers there that can definitely help you if you want to organize a trip. Not far from Canyons is Takaragawa Onsen. This is also a ryokan, meaning you can stay there overnight. It's a very traditional Japanese inn. But what I like about Takaragawa is it has lots of outdoor tubs.
Okay.
A lot of hot springs, they have indoor tubs. They may have a small, what's called a lotenburo, which is the outdoor tub. Takaragawa is unique in several ways in that these outdoor tubs are along the riverside, and they also have some co-ed tubs. They have a ladies-only tub, but they also have a tub for everyone, which is great if you're going with your spouse or if you're going with your kids and you want to sit in the tub together. This place is great in any season, but in the winter, it's one of those places where you're sitting in a tub naked, basically. Snow's falling in your hair, snow caked up half a meter thick on a rock in the river, and it's magical, and it's a great place to go. There's a transfer involved to get there. It's not a direct bullet train, but it takes about two and a half hours, I think, to get there, maybe three, and it's well worth an overnight trip.
Well, and we are unfortunately run out of time here, so we're going to need to wrap this up pretty quick because I have a meeting I have to go to. And Okay. The longer the show is, the more work I have to do at the end in terms of getting it ready for the audience. Any last words you want to say before we talk about our last four questions?
No, I think we've covered it. I think the big thing for people is just to know that it is affordable and it is navigable. Not everybody is going to be able to communicate with you in English, but if you are prepared with your translation apps, with a few characters written down, then you can make it. One thing I would say, if there are any vegetarians or vegans or anyone with allergies to seafood or shellfish, it can be a challenge to eat anywhere in Japan. Kyoto is easier. Kyoto is used to vegetarian and vegan travelers and vegan locals. But most food, most Japanese food, has at least some element of the sea in it.
Right.
One of the main components is dashi, which is made from bonito flakes. That's one of those things, if you have any particular food allergies or restrictions, you should prepare before you arrive.
Excellent. You're standing in the prettiest spot in Tokyo. Where are you standing? What are you looking at?
Wow. Okay. Well, I've told you about a couple of them, actually. I'm standing at the sunset at the top of the Mori building. I am sitting under a cherry blossom as the petals blow by my face. I'm sitting at a picnic at Inokashita Park, or even further out at a place called Shoakinen.
I said only one, so...
Sorry.
Stop you there. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in Tokyo.
There's a few of them. What would I say? Only in Tokyo. How about the time that I left my backpack with my laptop on a train and I just waited at the station for the train to go all the way around? It took an hour and I got back on the train and my bag was still sitting there.
And that says a lot. Excellent. Finish this thought. You really know you're in Tokyo when what?
You really know you're in Tokyo when you, when you're standing on a train and it's completely silent.
Oh, interesting.
After living in Taiwan for a few years where people are in your business in a good way, they're very friendly and talking to you and inviting you to, it was refreshing to move to Tokyo where no one bothers you. You don't have to worry about anybody in your face. And that was definitely one thing. You know you're in Tokyo when you don't have to look behind your back once. I got spoiled living there. It's so safe that you start to leave your wallet on the counter at a convenience store. You just realize you have to watch yourself when you leave.
And last question, if you had to summarize Tokyo in three words, what three words would you use?
I wish I was ready for this one.
That's why I asked if you'd ever heard the show before. These are always my last four questions.
I know. Well, I must have. Okay. Past, future, fusion.
Ah, excellent. Excellent. Our guest again has been Jason Andrew Jenkins from epiceducation.com and Epic Education Radio. Jason, do you have any great posts on Tokyo that we can refer people to?
I have quite a few, actually. I've written about a number of Tokyo neighborhoods, mostly from the family context of visiting with kids. But yes, I have quite a bit, and it's good for about anybody.
What is your favorite recent post that you wrote about Tokyo?
I wrote a big post about Tokyo food for picky eaters.
Oh, perfect. I may need that. I'm not a seafood eater.
Okay. Yes, there's something in there for you.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, Jason, thanks so much. We could have gone on, obviously, much longer. You know a lot about Tokyo. You have been there for so much time and clearly have a love for the city. Thank you for sharing with us.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine, Chris. I'm thrilled to be here.
We're going to skip the news of the community this week, except to say the trip to India is still happening in November of 2017. I hope you can join me on that. And with that, we'll end this episode of The Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. If you get a chance and you can rate this show in iTunes, that helps people find it. And thanks so much for listening.